Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea.
Hello and welcome to Campfires and Color Wars, a podcast about summer camps and the stories we love to tell about them. Like the time we liked cool and creamy in a variety of places on our bodies. I'm Micah Hart, and for the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to press pause on the world around us and transport back to the days of our adolescence, when the school year was just one long rest hour between days at camp. If you have a camp memory you'd like to have featured at the top of the show, or a guest that you would love to hear us speak with, you can always email us your short stories or your guest suggestions at summercamppod@gmail.com. And if you're going to take the time to do that, or you know what, if you're not going to take the time to do that, but you still want to do something to help the show, why not give it a review or a rating on iTunes so we can continue to reach as many former campers as we can. This was a really fun show. If you're a long-time listener of the show, you will notice that our production schedule has slowed a bit over the last year or so. You know, a lot of that is to do with just being busy, having a lot of stuff going on. But, you know, when I've had the opportunity to record episodes, a lot of the times it's kind of been less planned, if you will. In this particular case, I talk about this a little bit as I get into the conversation with today's guest, Max Schwerin. Sometimes I come across something and I see it, and I'm just like, all right, I've got to get that person on the show. And today is one of those episodes. I talk with Max Schwerin, who is a copywriter and a freelance journalist living in Singapore, which is super cool. He wrote an article about summer camp that I've seen a lot of articles about summer camp out there, and I dare say this one was different than most of them. We'll get into it with him in a minute, but I really, you know, he had a different take on summer camp than what I'm used to seeing, but he was a total good sport about it. We had a really, I think, really interesting conversation about the pros and cons to the summer camp experience. Obviously, I won the argument, let's be honest. No, I'm kidding. I really enjoyed talking to Mac. I really enjoyed hearing his perspective. I'll be curious to see what you think of it. So, let's get right to it. This is my conversation about summer camp, the pros and cons, the good and the bad, the bitches and the roses with, Max Schwerin. Mac, I'm gonna be honest with you. I was on vacation recently and I have a Google alert set up for summer camp, and I would say, you know, it comes every day into my inbox around noon, and probably 350 to 355 days of the year I barely register what is included in it and I delete it. But the other day I was on vacation, so maybe I was just taking a little more time, and I saw the very first headline. Here it is: the case against summer camp. And I was like, oh, I got to read this. And I read it, it was really, first of all, I thought it was a really interesting article, and I've read it several times since then, but I was like, well, I got to talk to this guy. Because the whole purpose of this podcast is really for people who probably have the opposite point of view that you do. And so I thought, obviously, I'm going to have you on, and we're just going to battle it out and figure out who is right and who is wrong. I somewhat kid. I definitely do want to argue with you about it. But I love getting other opinions on summer camp. And I think, it probably gets bland after a while if everybody you have on is just kind of telling the same version of the same story. So the fact that you had a different summer camp experience than I had, I want to hear all about it. And then I want to see if I can talk you out of that summer camp is a bad thing. But so let's start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your camp background. Where did you go? How long did you go for? Tell me a little bit about what that experience was like.
Sure. First of all, thanks so much for having me on. I was delighted to get your email and very surprised because because I do appreciate that it's a podcast that typically the guests you have on have mostly had positive experiences of camp.
Although we have definitely had guests who did not have positive experiences. So right. you're not the only one.
It is it's such an interesting experience because it's such a it represents such a spectrum for a lot of people. But in my case, I attended a camp called Robin Hood, which is in Maine. It was on the Penobscot Bay between the ages of 9 to 12. So that would have been summer of 1998 through the summer of 2001.
Okay.
As I say in the article, I basically hated it. I was extremely homesick. My first year, I went for 3 weeks. And the subsequent years, I went for 4 weeks. And I think my parents certainly didn't force me to go, but my understanding was all my friends went to summer camp in the summer, and it was sort of assumed that that was what you do. And it wasn't until I turned 13 that I realized I had more leverage in negotiations than I thought I did. So I think that my fourth and final year was actually the worst for me. Nothing traumatic happened specifically, but I was so homesick all the time and really didn't want to be there. And so I think I came home and put my size 5 foot down with my parents. And it was basically like, I don't want to do this again.
Now I have to ask, because you mentioned being homesick, what did your counselors do? Did they know you were homesick? I'm going to assume that they did. But what was their reaction to your homesickness? How did they try to counterbalance that?
I did make my grievances very public and well known. I remember everyone being incredibly supportive, and the counselors, you know, in their own way, would take me aside and sort of talk me through it. The recipe for getting over your homesickness appeared to be make more friends. And that advice didn't really work for me because I felt like I had a good number of friends. I was getting, you know, I wasn't totally antisocial. I was getting along with the other boys in my cabin. I just really didn't want to be there. And I think I remember that being sort of the crux of the issue when talking through it with counselors and staff. Because there are a certain number of points that I remember being made over and over, like, oh, you know, you're going to forget once you sort of get into the activities and once you start, you know, making more friends, you're just going to forget about home and you're going to be totally absorbed in this experience. And that was just not the case for me. But I do remember, the reason I didn't mention the camp name in my piece was because I didn't really want to drag Robin Hood specifically.
Sure.
Because it was really, and the director, I interacted with the director a lot over the course of 4 years, especially in my capacity as a camper on the campers council.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah, he was an incredibly kind man and obviously really cared about the kids, you know, in his remit. And yeah, so I it's not that I can fault any of the staff or counselors. They were all great. It's just I was having a terrible time, and as far as I was concerned, nothing was going to make that better.
Okay, so how do we get, because the picture you're painting, it seems like you had a good response from your counselors, and it seems like you had a compassionate camp director and some friends, so maybe you weren't, you know, a complete outcast. So I guess then my question for you is, how do you go from that, which is, all right, maybe it's not for me, but it wasn't a complete and total, like, negative experience around me, to the case against summer camp?
Sure. Yeah, because it is something of a big leap. And I think a lot of it had to do with, really, I only decided what I thought about camp in retrospect. And it's sort of, it took me, you know, for a long time, camp was just a curiosity. And I didn't have any fond memories of it, but there was a bit of, not nostalgia necessarily, but you know, I had memories from camp. It was an incredibly formative time. And I just sort of, as I got older, I just sort of took for granted that that's just a pillar of the experience of youth. And it really only, you know, when I went to high school and then college, did I start looking back and being like, well, that was sort of a really gratuitous experience for me, in the sense that it didn't have to happen. It didn't, as I said, it wasn't a traumatic experience necessarily, but I started to sort of interrogate the assumptions behind sending kids to camp in the first place. And the longer I thought about that, the more that I sort of came to the conclusion that not only wasn't it for me, but the very fabric of camp is a little perverse. that's kind of, I couldn't get away from that thought that, that this is a thing that is historically contingent. I mean, first of all, it's really an American institution. I mean, there are summer camps all over the world, but no other country, I think, has a relationship to the institution of summer camp like America does.
I would definitely agree with that. At least anecdotally, I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah, and so it's more, you know, once you begin to accept that this is not a natural state of affairs, or that you know, camp itself is predicated on being from a certain place and being in a certain time, that's when I think you can start to really question what it's all about. And you know, the answers I came up with weren't flattering to the institution, and that's sort of the spirit that I tried to capture in the piece.
So I obviously have many thoughts on this, but one of the things I want to clarify with you, because one of the things that was really interesting to me in reading your piece, one is, for someone who has been doing a summer camp podcast for the last 2.5 years, I actually did not know the origins of summer camp. I've come across it in bits and pieces, it was surprising to me to learn that this came from a Protestant background.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm Jewish, and I would say even more to the point of what you're saying about summer camp being integral to the American experience, it is specifically integral to the Jewish American experience. It was surprising to me to learn that it came out of a Protestant movement and not out of the Jewish movement. And I think that I can certainly understand where you're coming from when I think about, like, you went to boarding school and you talked about kind of the elitism of your experience with camp, or the camp world that you're referring to.
Right.
Yeah, I can totally get that. When I think about, you know, like, when I picture a boarding school, I pretty much picture like school ties. And I'm not saying that every...
I wore them.
You know, so...
That's accurate.
That's... Okay, so that's an incredibly elitist institution. It is propping up the elites and making the connections that they'll continue to have, so they'll continue to have power and hegemony and all that kind of stuff. So I totally understand that point of view. In the Jewish world, at least in my experience, it served a much different purpose. And for me, growing up in the Deep South, that was like the only place that I had to have sort of a larger Jewish community to be a part
Sure.
of. Now, that's in the Deep South. It's different if you go to New York, and so many of the camps in the Northeast, you know, are, even if they're not built as Jewish camps, most of the campers that go there are Jewish, so it ends up being a de facto Jewish camp one way or the other.
Right.
You know, that sense of, I need to be here so I can feel a part of something, I don't know that it's that, as it's not as vital. It might still be a part of it, but it's maybe not the fabric of it the way it is or was for us in the Deep South. But I wonder, had you, I guess, I don't even know where I'm going with this, but in my head I'm thinking, I wonder if you'd had an experience like that, that was more about, here's a place where you can belong, as opposed to, here is a place where we are ensuring that we have this enclave for perpetuity. I wonder if it would have changed your point of view at all.
Yeah, very possibly. And I think that's a really good point. And to the idea that that you thought of camp as being a quintessentially Jewish institution, I think in a way that's sort of dead on. And that so that was what led me to pitch this piece in the beginning. Was I came across this book by Leslie Paris about sort of the history of summer camps, because I was completely unaware. And its Protestant background really had mostly to do with the fact that it was originally a New England institution that catered to the sort of increasingly urban destinations of like New York and Philadelphia and Boston. And I think that's also why it very quickly, she explains in the book, it started out as this Protestant thing, but other religious organizations, kind of these new constituencies, started horning in. And of course, the Jewish population in the U.S. circa the late 18th century was predominantly, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. And so that's part of the reason why, first of all, so many camps are located there in general. Yep. And why so many of them, even if they're not explicitly affiliated with any religion, you know, there are de facto Jewish camps, de facto Protestant camps. My camp, for instance, was secular in almost every way, except I do remember every morning during morning assembly, we would say the Lord's Prayer. Okay. So there was a vestige of, you know, whatever Episcopalian sort of background. It was founded in 1925. But yeah, I mean, definitely, I think if camp is providing a sense of community that you're not getting at home, and especially if you feel like an outcast in your normal day-to-day life, I think that can be a valuable thing. I think the sense I got from reading this book, which was very edifying, was that these early camps were efforts at continuing a kind of tutelage that was already happening throughout the rest of the year. And so the early Jewish camps in New England, first of all, would attract students through word of mouth at their schools and at their synagogues. So often you would basically just be transplanting an existing community to, right, you know, some other place in the woods for the summer.
Yep.
And it was really all about, you know, Paris in her book brings up the fact that camps were almost more homogenous than, let's say you were living in New York, let's say you were living in Bushwick, you're a Jewish kid in Bushwick in the early 1900s, you would have exposure to different groups, ethnicities, you know, religions, communities. In Brooklyn, you know, some of these people would be living mere blocks away from you. And then if you go to camp for the summer, you're actually going to a much more homogenous place that has sort of isolated itself from that kind of rich fabric of your day-to-day urban life. So, I mean, to your point, if that's not the case, if you're somebody who's living in a place where you don't have much of a sense of a community, then I think camp can provide that. And I think there's value in that, definitely. But I don't think of that as being the legacy of camp. And I'm not sure that constitutes, you know, the majority of campers' experiences. Now, that's probably unfair of me to say, because this is all anecdotal and personal experience. And sure, this, you know, this book was the one, was the foundation of the piece, but of course is speaking about camps, you know, 150 to 100 years ago.
Right.
And I think things have certainly changed, but, but yeah, I think camp can have that value for some. I'm not sure that's typical of camp.
So obviously I probably disagree with that, but you know, one of the things that I in reflecting on my experience in reading your piece, you talked about sort of the, it builds character one way or another, right? Like if you're a loner and you end up miserable and hating it, that's still a character building experience, just as it would be if you're there like making friends and having a blast and whatever. I think that's probably accurate. I think, you know, my experience, at least, and again, all of this is just my own experience, and the experience of, you know, my friends and the people that I've talked to. But we always talk about camp as a place where you found yourself. You know, my dad's camp in particular, he had this whole utopian notion of summer camp as this place where kids could get away from the normal school year and all of the things that, you know, can give a kid anxiety and lack for self-confidence, you know, trying out for sports teams and dating and all the stuff. And he thought of camp really as this, you know, again, this utopian place where a kid could just be himself. And I've found a lot of people who say that camp is really where they found out who they were. And I think that's incredibly valuable. The question is, I suppose, if I'm you, is could they not have found that another way? But
yeah, I mean, my counter to that would be between the ages of, let's say, 8 and 16, you are going to find out who you are. Childhood is formative, I think, no matter what. I think, you know, it depends on what your view of personality is and a sort of nurture versus nature question that is as old as time. Your particular experiences, I think, do shape in part the person that you're going to become. I also think the nature of growing up is that you you discover yourself in time. I think clearly a lot of people, the reason they have positive experiences at camp, or the reason they believe they have positive experiences at camp, not to gaslight you. I'm sure everyone.
Oh yeah, you think you had a good time, but really?
No, I believe everyone who tells me they had a good time at camp, I certainly believe them.
Sure.
But I mean, what I bring up in the piece is that the social conditions and parameters of summer camp, I think, often mirror or are kind of a bizarro world instantiation of the social conditions and parameters of school. I think it's a microcosm. A lot of the same stuff is happening. You're going to a cafeteria and you're having your meals. You're playing your sports. You know, you're doing some version of, at my camp, we had Friday evening dances. You're doing some version of, I'm discovering myself sexually. I'm discovering that I'm interested in other people romantically. What's that going to be like? How is that going to play out? I think camp takes all those things that happen very gradually over the course of years in your regular life, and they kind of bottle them up, and it's almost this supercharged experience.
And see, I would argue, from my point of view, that that's a good thing, that you learned much faster, I think, and also, I would say, in a safer environment, because you're in this situation where you have to spend so much time with this group of people that you have to adapt faster, and you have to learn faster how to deal with different personalities and deal with, you know, difficulties and handle, you know, conflict, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, that's all to the positive side of the ledger.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think, well, in terms of, I briefly alluded to this near the end of the piece, but to your point about it happening in a safe environment, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly true, in the sense that there are no federal, you know, school is something that's so stringently regulated in the U.S., obviously. Schools have to be accredited. Teachers have to have certain credentials. And it's just a much more monitored environment. And in the U.S., there is no federal law governing the operation of summer camps. A lot of states don't even require background checks for employees that work at summer camp. There are very few state statutes that are specific to summer camps. Obviously, if you're operating a summer camp and you're taking children into your protection, you're under you report to somebody in the sense that, you know, some version of your state health and human services has jurisdiction. But there is nothing really particular to summer camps. And there is, you know, CNN just came out with a report a year or two ago about an enormous level of abuse cases that sort of nobody had really talked about before. Whether kids are actually safer at summer camp than they would be anywhere else, I think, is in dispute. Now, part of the reason why I didn't go into that in great detail in the piece was because I wanted to address summer camp on sort of its own terms.
Sure.
And not, because the same could be said about anything. I mean, certainly there's abuse at school, and in any institution, there is an element of risk and danger. And I'm also not an advocate for some kind of nanny state. I don't necessarily think states need to come out with a whole, you know, raft of legislation governing summer camps. But I don't take it for granted that camps are safe spaces where kids are better off going through the trials and tribulations of childhood than they would be in their normal environment.
I see what you're saying. And I'll say, for one, what's interesting, what I've learned. So my oldest son went to camp for the first time this summer. I'm learning, getting sort of back into the camp mix now, having been out of it for the last 20 years, how much really has changed towards what you're saying. Like, I think at some point, probably people were like, you know, maybe we need to reassess, like, how we run these things. And is it, like, just as one example, I don't think, generally speaking, and I might be getting this slightly wrong, but I don't think at this point you're really allowed as a counselor to be alone with an individual camper. I think there's ways around it now, protocols in place to protect probably, you know, everybody involved, to keep them out of situations that could lead to, you know, dangerous outcomes. That was nowhere near anyone's radar when I was growing up.
Right.
I mean, we talked about coverage. That was the term for staff members, of like just making sure that there was enough counselors around where kids were so we had eyes on people.
Sure.
But the thought that you couldn't go do something with an individual camper, like, what are you talking about? That's absurd. You know, it's really, they've changed a lot of the thinking on a lot of stuff like that, and a lot of things about, you know, inclusion, you know, which you talked about a little bit in your piece. And again, I think towards the positive of acknowledging that things have changed a lot for inclusiveness, and even, you know, niche camps for specific kinds of kids, whether that is, you know, from disadvantaged backgrounds or LGBTQ background, you know, that kind of stuff, to, you know, create these environments where you can be around other people who are like you, where you may not have that opportunity otherwise. So I do think it has changed a lot, probably because people realize some of the things that you're that you're referencing.
When I was at Robin Hood, I think that transition was probably beginning. I think the management and staff had a much more robust view of their own responsibilities towards kids. And yeah, as you say, as I bring up in the piece, I think all of those are positive, unequivocally positive developments. At the same time, does that neuter the closer camp gets to school, the more that camp's original ethos is sort of neutered. And so, you know, that just raises the question, is camp changing for the better on its own terms, or are we bringing camp more in line with all of these other institutions of childhood, because we recognize that camp as this kind of Wild West, you know, proto raw experience actually isn't, you know, an unalloyed good. It is, it's risky and it's unpredictable and it's inconsistent. And, all of those things we normally, none of those things are really good for children. In most other aspects of modern life, the idea of something being unpredictable and inconsistent and potentially unsafe That's a surefire way to make sure that children aren't exposed to it.
I do think camps are definitely changing, and they are becoming more rigorous in their, you know, philosophy. You know, to your point, becoming more and more, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is, but if you want to call it like school, you know, I do think that is probably happening. And the funny thing is I'm sure it's for the better. I think I talked about this on our last episode. I'm sure that's for the better, but the old, you know, cantankerous man in me is like, ah, I don't want it that way. I liked it the way it was, you know, wild and free.
Right.
But all right, so I want to talk a little bit more about some of the things that you referenced in your piece, and that is in particular the Camper Council. So tell us a little bit more about what that was and how you got involved in it.
Yeah, so that was really, you know, that burns brightest in terms of my memories of camp, and I think it was very particular to Robin Hood. I'm sure, you know, versions of it exist at other camps, but it felt like a very special thing.
I've never heard of it, so I'm very curious.
it was basically just an organization comprised within the camp, comprised of a certain number of campers. I want to say at any given time there were between 10 and 20 campers on this council. They were effectively handpicked by the camp director. I think they voted, you know, they basically nominated somebody to be on it, and the camp director said okay. And the purpose of the council was basically to be this intermediary between the rest of the campers and management and staff.
Which is such a funny concept. How old are these kids? Are these all, like, taken from the oldest age group? Is it a smattering of all different age groups?
It's a smattering, yeah. I mean, as I remember it, it was supposed to be this kind of representative cross-section of the camper body. So I was brought on in my fourth and final year, so I was 12, and I think the ages ranged from 10 to 15 or 16were the oldest campers at Robin Hood.
I'm just imagining a 10-year-old being like, we need more Mickey Mouse bars. Like, there's not enough Mickey Mouse ice cream bars in the canteen. And that's my number one platform that I want to address.
Yeah, and I say this, I mean, it's a joke, but it's also true. I remember in the piece, I bring up more fluff for our fluffer nutters. I'm pretty sure that was on the docket. I'm pretty sure that was like a policy discussion we had during one of our meetings. And the impetus for my writing the piece was remembering Campers Council and thinking about it as an adult and being like, what was the purpose of this? Because we weren't doing anything. We weren't really doing anything substantive. Although I will say, as I also mentioned in the piece, I believe during my summer, there was one case of everyone was very upset with the counselor, and we got him reprimanded in some way, or possibly even got him fired.
Do you remember what the grievance was?
I mean, I don't really.
Okay.
I suspect, and I didn't want to make this allegation in the piece, even though I didn't name the counselor and don't even remember his name. I suspect it's possible that he was overly attentive towards younger female campers. I mean,
gotcha.
In my mind, if in fact he was fired, that had to have been the reason.
Okay.
It's also possible he was just, I remember it was a man. It was possible he was just kind of aloof or rude or,
sure.
You know, campers felt that he wasn't a compassionate dude, and that might've been the issue.
Okay.
And that was the one admittedly very substantive thing that we had a say in.
Yeah.
But by and large, the stuff we were discussing during these meetings, and they happened maybe once a week, maybe once every other week. I mean, it was very sort of ad hoc. And there was really no purpose except to sort of inculcate the idea. I mean, this is my takeaway now, and this is what I talk about in the piece. The purpose of Campers Council was to get a certain elite subsection of an already elite camp to begin familiarizing themselves with the levers of power. And that sounds, I know that sounds ridiculous, but that that sort of was the my experience at the time was, okay, I'm going to go into – it was very dramatic also. We always met – so as I mentioned, the camp was on the shores of Penobscot Bay in Maine, and the campers council always convened at this like dramatic cliffside at night.
I'm picturing like stonecutters from The Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it felt – it was – you know, it was – I'm sure some of those members went on to be members of Skull and Bones for the – fucking Freemasons. I mean, I don't even know. But that was essentially, it was a simulacrum of a secret society.
Yeah.
And we met in secret, and I think we were supposed to not talk about our deliberations with other campers, although, because we're kids, it's of course exactly what we went back to our cabins did.
Sure. Yeah, and I can definitely understand where seeing camp and witnessing a thing like that, whether you were a part of it or not, could shape your opinion to where it was or to where it is. It's funny to me because, one, something like that would never fly at the camps that I went to because it was all about, you know, egalitarian and everybody is equal and nobody is above each other, et cetera. At least from a, you know, I mean, obviously that's going to happen on its own, but
right,
certainly
from
not
structural
from a
perspective.
Right. But at the same time, I'm like, man, I so wish we'd had that when I was a counselor, because it would have been endless fodder for humor. Like, we would have done nothing with what they did other than just laugh and laugh and laugh. Like, like we would present it to the kids like it was so important, and they would take whatever it is that they came back with, and we would probably just have sat in the staff lounge and read it out loud to each other and laughed our asses off. And that would have been the end of it, and it would have been just for our amusement.
Yeah, and I'm confident that's exactly how it went down 99% of the time with Campers Council. And I mean, certainly it felt, even looking back, it felt extremely particular to my camp.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I could redo the piece in any way, I probably wouldn't hang the personal essay portion on Campers Council, because I recognize that it's nothing like a universal camp experience.
Sure.
But I also think in my mind, it's sort of solidified the other aspects of camp that I think are a little bit more universal. The social hierarchies that form naturally. I mean, let's take as a given that every camp attempts to be egalitarian, except apparently mine. you know, that's true for school as well. That's true for most public spaces where kids find themselves. And I think hierarchies do form, and I think hierarchies are predicated on the things that they're always predicated on, and that when you grow up, they're predicated on, which is, are you socially adept? Are you good looking? Are you charming? Are you a good athlete? Do you have an innate ability to make people like you? And I mean, that, you know, the discrepancies between people when it comes to those things, like, that's life. And I get that. But it felt very poignant when you're 9 or 10 or 11, and your social standing in camp has a lot to do with how you tick those boxes. And I think, you know, that was the part of my experience that I would regard as universal. And I think whether people had a positive or negative experience at camp, I think elements of what I write about in the piece, hopefully they identified with a little or resonated a little, even if they disagree, you know, even if in their minds that's constructive. I would hope that those sorts of elements resonated.
So I have two last questions and then move on. One, do you have any siblings, and did they like camp?
So I have three siblings. My eldest sister, I have two older sisters. My eldest went to Robin Hood for a year and hated it and somehow convinced my parents not to send her back.
Okay.
And then a couple years after is when I started attending. So yeah, I mean, and I think it becomes a generational thing. My parents went to summer camp, but not this particular one. Yeah. But you mentioned your kids. You have kids now in summer camp.
Yeah, my oldest is 7 and just went for 10 days for the first time.
Yeah. And I assume what was his experience like? Did he went to the same camp as you did?
He did. He did end up going to the same camp. That was not a given necessarily. But he did end up going to the same camp I grew up at. And he had a blast.
Yeah, that's great.
I think he's, you know, somewhat groomed to have a good time at camp because he sees all of his friends around him who, like, I have a lot of friends to this day who are close friends of mine from summer camp. Some people I'm friends with in Atlanta, we went to camp together. So there's this whole community, you know, that still is a living thing that he's now a part of. And honestly, you know, it was a great article, but I think I'm going to pitch to you that you should turn this into a book and you should go back to camp now for a summer and challenge and find out if where you're at now is where you would end up at the end. Because I wonder if you had a different camp, if it would change your experience at all. Not knocking Robin Hood. I'm sure it's a lovely place. So my second question for you then is, what has the response been to your piece? Because camp people take it seriously. They love camp.
Yeah, I certainly anticipated a bit of pushback. I was surprised at the overwhelming negative response. I will say the one thing I'm grateful for, so Vox published it across, they put it out on Facebook and Twitter. And luckily, I was not ratioed on either of those platforms, although I came dangerously close. Almost every written comment was negative, probably, I'd say, like 90 to 95%. And I was sort of shocked because...
I'm not shocked.
Yeah. Well, of course, now I understand. It was as though I was attacking a really as sacred an institution as... you know, as a church or synagogue, as a sacred institution as religion. And I think in my mind, you know, I sort of intended the piece to be funny. I mean, my thesis sentences is I submit that camp as an institution fully sucks, which isn't quite tongue in cheek because I actually believe that.
Right.
But also was meant to be somewhat self-aware that, you know, that I'm out here throwing bombs and, you know, I'm being a spoil sport, come at me.
It's a contrarian point of view.
It really did.
There's no question about that. You don't see, and again, I have a Google alert set up for summer camp. I don't often see pieces deriding the summer camp experience. They typically come to praise camp, not to bury it.
Right. And I think my tidings were met with hostility and with a lack of humor, which I totally, it's not that I think the readers who vehemently disagreed with the piece are humorless at all.
Sure.
I think they, you know, I think they feel that this article, as, you know, as modest as it was, it's one voice among a sea of millions, was an attack on something that they feel, you know, made them who they are in part.
Yeah. I mean, without question, I feel that way about my summer camp experience. Like I said, there are definitely pieces of what you wrote that I absolutely understand and can relate to and see value in. But I think for me, again, some of the things that you point out, I would look at and say the exact same things, but would point them out as a positive and not as a negative.
Yeah,
but the elitism, without question. Like I, you know, I'm an oppressed minority, like lots of others. So I get the pushback against things that are trying to keep power structures in place.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, it is in my mind, camp is really a middle to upper middle class institution, and a lot of people were very quick to say, there are organizations, there are scholarships, there are funds, and that's absolutely true. You know, that's also true of elite sort of liberal arts colleges that provide scholarship to a minority of its attendees. That, you know, in my mind, that doesn't that doesn't really mitigate the impression that that camp leaves a foul taste in my mouth. No.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that, but I'm glad we got to discuss it civilly, you son of a bitch. No, I'm just kidding. All right, let's move on to our Campfires and Color Wars questionnaire, title still pending. Our first question, tell us about, this is, all this feels very funny to ask you now after the conversation we've just had, but I'm going to ask you anyway. We didn't get into whether yours was a co-ed camp, although you said your sister went, so I'm going to assume it was. So tell us about if you had the most romantic moment you had at camp.
So it was co-ed. I had nothing even approaching a romantic moment. I think when I started camp as a 9 and 10 year old, I'm guessing I wasn't, girls weren't really on my radar. I do remember in my third or fourth year at camp when I was 11 or 12, one of my good friends, Anthony, really liked this girl. I'm pretty sure her name was Emily. And I, of course, harbored a secret crush on Emily. And I remember at one of the Friday dances, they were dancing together. And of course, I'm in the dark corner brooding. And that was that unrequited love was probably as close as I ever got to any kind of romantic encounter.
So basically, if Emily had danced with you, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now.
If Emily had danced with me, I would be camp's biggest defender, and you would be reading my praise.
That's what it all comes back to. Now.
Yeah, always.
All right, number two, tell us about your best camp performance.
So I do remember that Robin Hood had a regular talent show, and I had learned at one point, I can't remember which year this was, but earlier in the year I had learned, do you remember that thing where somebody would sit behind you and they'd put their arms through your armpits and they'd put
classic,
their leg up?
Classic staple of camp talent shows. Absolutely.
Classic staple. I'm sure this had been performed at Robin Hood many times. I'm sure it's still being performed, but it was a radical display of conceptual audacity when my friend and I did it at the talent show. And I remember it totally brought the house down.
Now, were you the hands or were you the front man?
I was the face. I was the guy making the horrified expressions while he was doing everything.
it's Camp Greatest Hits for a reason. It never fails to impress.
Yeah, it's always well received. So yeah, that I do remember that, and I remember that being a fun oasis. That's in great. In a desert of horror.
Oh man! All right, number three. Tell us about this. This should, I hope. I mean, I don't say I hope, but given your point of view on camp, maybe you'll have a good one here. Tell us about your most embarrassing moment at camp.
Yeah. So I'm sure I had dozens of these. One that comes to mind, I think this was my first year. It was probably like my first week or even in the first couple of days. There were communal showers, obviously, and I was just like deathly afraid of any public space where people could see me naked. Having people not look at my dick was like a very high priority for 9-year-old Mac. So I remember I was starting to smell after a couple days, and bathing was mandatory. Like I think there was actually a rule that you had to bathe like at least semi-regularly.
Solid rule.
And I didn't know what to do, so I put on a bathing suit and I brought a bottle of shampoo and a bar of soap into the lake. The camp was situated on a lake. It was in between Penobscot Bay and this small lake. And I like bathed myself in the lake, which people found very peculiar. And there was like a gaggle of people kind of looking at me, wondering what the hell I was doing. Cause I'm sure looking back, it was really more of a pond. And I'm sure it was just pretty gross and like algae and like seaweed. And yeah, I definitely remember halfway through bathing myself in the lake, looking onto the shore and seeing this group of people watching me and being like, oh, I'm screwing this up in some way. This is bad.
Now, see, this reminds me of something, and you're right. You did mention that in your article, and this is something where, again, I would love to know how this has evolved over time, because I think it probably has. But I would posit that that was one of the beautiful things about camp, was that it forced you to be naked around other people. And I think, honestly, I think that was a good thing. I think you had to become more comfortable with your body. You saw other shapes and sizes of people. And, you know, I knew lots of kids who were exactly the way you were.
Right.
And ultimately would get older and be much more free, probably uncomfortably so, around each other. And I would always joke about the fact that, like, I could be naked around my camp friends all day, every day, but put me back in the school year and, like, I would never, ever let anybody see me naked that I went to school with. Right. So there was a level of shared comfort there. But I also can, in today's mindset, imagine a scenario where that is frowned upon. And that you wouldn't force anybody to be, you know, naked if they didn't want to be naked.
Right. Yeah. And like we were talking about, to your point, that camp in a way sort of supercharges or makes earlier experiences that would happen naturally. I certainly got over it. I'm not quite as neurotic as I was then. But, you know, at the same time, my thinking was I would have gotten over it anyway. You know, I went to boarding school, in high school, I would have been naked around, you know, if you play a sport and you go back to the showers, that would tend to happen naturally.
Right.
So it's really, and this is sort
there's
of
there's no ponds next to the boys' locker room at school.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really the only option at school. And so I think a lot of the unspoken crux of the piece is, you know, in due time, did I need to go through that when I was 9? When I would have gone through it anyway at a more gradual pace later on. Almost all of the experiences I had at camp were replicated in some form as I grew up. They were replicated in junior high and then high school, boarding school. They were replicated in college and early adulthood. And it's just, I think kids are ready when they're ready. And I think I remember at 9 feeling pretty vulnerable and exposed.
Yeah.
You know, and I had friends who went to camp younger. Your son, you said, mentioned was 7.
Yep.
Yeah. I had friends who I think went, yes, 6 or 7. Some of them had awesome times and got right into it. And some of them, like me, I think had trouble because they just felt, I'm away from home. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not ready for this. I think it all, the question of who feels like they got something out of it and who feels like they would have preferred to wait to experience whatever the thing is, I think that, you know, could maybe be the demarcation between people who had a good time at camp and people who didn't. And I think some kids are ready, you know, at an earlier age and some aren't.
Interestingly enough, because you did go to boarding school, I find that boarding school is a camp-like environment in and of itself, because you're in a shared space with people, you're not at home. It's obviously longer, much longer, but there are a lot of similarities. So it's almost like you stopped going to camp, but then went to camp.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And there are definitely a lot of similarities in that. Yeah, you're being away from the parental unit. That's really one of the most formative things.
Yep.
A lot of people who go to neither camp nor boarding school really don't experience that until they go to college or they move out and they get a job.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways, boarding school felt like camp, and boarding school itself is, you know.
So maybe what you're reacting to is boarding school more than camp. That's what I'm gonna take away from this conversation.
Several commenters were like, "It's funny that he focuses on camp when it sounds like all of these other institutions he attended were equally elitist. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that boarding school is a recognized target. And, you know, especially in 2019, I think, you know, the place that boarding school has in the popular imagination is this place of, you know, very alienating, establishment defending elitism. I think, you know, this was also, just as you say, that my boarding school experience was like my camp experience. You know, I came to the same conclusion. And I think as I got older, I realized they were of a piece, and that maybe they had more to do with each other than I had previously sort of supposed. And maybe the reason that was because a lot of the things that I saw being promoted and defended at my boarding school were things that were promoted and defended much earlier on.
Yeah, no, I totally can see that. All right, number four, lovely segue, top bunk or bottom bunk?
Top, always top. I can't remember when. Do you remember Black Sheep? That
sure.
Farley gets the top bunk and lands on David Spade, and I think I saw that at a very impressionable age, and I was like, "All right, top bunk forever."
That's right. It's not gonna be me.
It's not gonna be me.
That's funny. All right, number five. If you could change one thing about your camp experience, what would it be?
I mean, is it a cop out to say
outside of not going?
No, I wouldn't go. That's a good question. I mean, I think it's not like I can go back and make myself into a confident, gregarious 10-year-old who was willing to step outside of his comfort zone. But, you know, if I could redo anything, it would be to try and push myself to befriend the people I wouldn't think of befriending, to play the sports and do the activities that wouldn't have occurred to me to do at the time. And that also, I think the confidence to step outside your comfort zone and embrace a different side of your own personality is something that comes gradually. And that's what sort of maturation is all about. And I think, you know, I wish I was the kind of kid who could have been comfortable doing that. And the fact that I wasn't, I'm sure, colored the rest of the experience. But yeah, in a general sense, that's what I would push myself to do. Starting with, you know, playing sport. I got to camp and I was like, all right, tennis. My parents play it. People seem to do it. You know, tennis. You know, why not something crazy? I'm trying to think of what other. You know, my camp had skateboarding, and I would have never stepped on a skateboard. And it's just that, you know, you at that age, I remember taking my cues from what the people I knew growing up with did, and my parents and their friends, and my friends back at home, and thinking, all right, what? Not necessarily what's expected of me. I don't think anyone. It would be unfair to say that my parents had any expectations. For my experience at summer camp, really, they just wanted me out of the house. But I do think, you know, in large part, my experience was formed by what I thought I should be doing at camp.
Yeah.
And to the extent I could have changed that, I definitely would have had a different and probably more positive experience.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, again, you know, the things you're referencing are things that I would say are what makes camp great, which is that it gives you the, I'm sad that you look back and say, I wish I had taken more advantage of that, because I would say, I agree. Right. That's a great thing, is that it gives you the chance to try things you've never tried before and do it.
Certainly.
In, again, what I would consider a safe environment, meaning you could try them and no one's going to know anything about it, outside of you and, you know, the people you're around, and they don't know you from home. So if
right.
you show up and say, yeah, I'm going to play tennis. And, you know, as far as they know, you play tennis. So you go and play it. Nobody cares. No one knows any different.
Yeah.
So you can kind of be this, what you want to be, as opposed to perhaps what you think you should be, you know, like you made during the year. But, all right, well, let's move on to our final segment, which is Bitches and Roses, a.k.a. Roses and Thorns, a.k.a. Coals and Diamonds, a.k.a. Strawberries and Lemons, a.k.a. Peaks and Valleys, a.k.a. Pals and Wows. A lot of different names for this one. This is just a chance for us to each share one good thing and one bad thing going on in our lives. It can be small or big. But Mac, as the guest, I will happily give you the opportunity to go first. What's good and what's bad these days for you?
Well, we were talking earlier about, before we started recording, about how I had just moved to Singapore with my wife almost a year ago in October. And that, so far, my experience here has been both really great and bad in a lot of ways, in the sense that it's an adventure, it's a really cool city, but you are on the other side of the planet from friends and family. It's tough. It's always tough, you know, maintaining friendships into adulthood. And it's like that much harder when you sort of have to schedule calls and FaceTime in this very narrow window because America is 12 to 16 hours behind Singapore. So, yeah, so that's been and I think I'm sure anyone who's lived abroad for an extended amount of time, that's the double-edged sword, I think, of doing that. And I think that's you need the bad with the good, because you need the realization that, you know, no place is perfect, and wherever you go in the world, there you are. But yeah, I would say that Singapore itself has been both a very positive experience and has come with its share of cons.
Cool. Well, my bitch is I played basketball this past weekend for the first time in like a year, and they always say you're only as old as you feel, and you know, I think most people feel like they are younger than they actually are. I'm 40. I probably peg my age in my mind at, I don't know, 17, maybe early 20s. But playing basketball was a not so gentle reminder that I am getting older. I knew it too. I was like, I played on Sunday, and I'm like, Monday morning is gonna be rough. And I'm a finesse player. I'm not a banger. I'm not down in the post, you know, bodying people up, and you know, I'm not playing like I'm Charles Oakley. I'm pretty much just loitering around the perimeter shooting threes. And I was so sore.
Yeah.
And it's just really, really disappointing.
I mean, my knees have started clicking like every one out of every three times I stand up. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah. So that's definitely my bitch. My rose is my wife and I were fortunate enough to get away on vacation recently, and we went to Italy and Switzerland, and those are both gorgeous places. I had not been to Switzerland in 20 years, and there was this beer. I was in Interlaken. I traveled around Europe with some friends from college after we graduated about 20 years ago, and had this beer in Interlaken that was just the best beer I'd ever had.
What was it?
It's called Rugenbrau. It is nothing special. I mean, it's just like a local, seriously, it's like a local craft beer.
Yeah.
But in my mind, it was like this temple of, you know, excellence, and you couldn't get it anywhere. Like, I almost to the point, I was like, did I remember? Is that the right name? Did I really have it? So we were going back to Switzerland, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get to try it again if it still exists. And sure enough, it does exist. And I will say, I tried to find it. We were staying a little bit outside of Interlaken, and we were going hiking, and I couldn't find it in a bar, but there was this little grocery store that sold it in a can. So I bought it, and it wasn't that cold, and I was kind of disappointed with it, and I was like, ah, this is why nostalgia sucks, because nothing's ever as good as you remember it. But then the next day, my wife and I went hiking. And we hiked to the top of this like mountain place, and there was a restaurant there, and they served it cold in a glass, and I had one.
Oh, nice.
Oh, so good. It was so good. I mean, all of the, spoiler alert, it didn't matter that it was Rugenbrau. All the beer in Switzerland is amazing because the water is so pure.
right. True, yeah.
But it was definitely nice to see, like, okay, I'm not crazy. This is delicious. And I very much enjoyed it. So
it's almost better that the first time was a little disappointing, so that it could redeem itself in your mind.
Absolutely.
What a triumph.
That's right. You gotta have the lows to appreciate the highs, without question.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that, that is our show. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, any other podcast listening tools you can find. If you want to find us on social media, we are on Facebook and Twitter at Summer Camp Pod and on Instagram at Campfires and Color Wars. If you want to send us your comments on why Mac is right, or more likely, why Mac is wrong about summer camp, you can always email us at summercamppod@gmail.com. And Mac, if people want to find you on the internet, where can we send them?
I'm on Twitter at Mac Schwerin, MacSchwerin, and that's probably the best. Yeah, you can add to my paltry subscriber count, follower count. That's probably the best place to reach me.
Okay, well, and be civil, people. This is all it's all part of the discourse. Oh, it's okay.
I've heard it all so far.
If you want to hear more from me, I'm on Twitter at Micah Hart. And with that, we will say goodbye. Mac, my dad would always say at camp that, time is precious. You got to make the most of it. You got to make it count. So he'd always tell us, he would always say, don't waste a minute. So I will say to you, Mac, don't waste a minute, Mac. And you can say back to me,
don't waste a minute, Micah.
Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself be. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs.